Good morning. I call the House Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee to order. A quorum has been established. Today we are hearing from two agencies, Minnesota Management and Budget and the Department of Administration. First, we will approve the minutes from the December 17th, 2025 meeting. Vice Chair Anderson, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I move approval.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. All right.
I just had a really brief statement I wanted to make before we get into the agenda. If I can, it will be short.
You know, I would like to get through that, but first I want to, they've asked me to make a statement from the sergeant's office, so I'm going to start with that, if you don't mind.
Of course, Madam Chair.
So the chair is in control, and we have an outline of expectations for our audience. So there are no signs, no outbursts, no clapping, no standing or sitting in the walkways and aisles. If accommodation is needed, please meet with the sergeant staff. They're wearing yellow ties, and they are happy to assist you. If there is disruption, removal from the committee room will be the consequence. Tickets may have been issued for this hearing, I'm not sure, but during regular session there will be tickets. So, you know, just so everyone gets used to the flow of how committees are going to run, we want everything to be smooth, we want the public to feel welcome, and we just want to make sure that everything runs according to plan. So we're grateful for the partnership of the sergeant's office in all of these things, and we welcome the public. You're always welcome, and we just want to have a hearing that make sure everyone is heard and that there's decorum. So thank you all very much. With that, Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that notice and for this indulgence. As we prepare to work through the really important agenda for today, it felt critical to acknowledge the crisis that many of our constituents are really feeling traumatized by. Right now, there are thousands of federal immigration agents in our state at enormous expense. And often we've learned without coordination with our local law enforcement or even in defiance of them, their leaders claim that they have absolute immunity from liability for anything that they do. And with that impunity, we've learned that they've targeted Minnesotans of color, including police officers, we learned yesterday, detained U.S. citizens without cause, used force on observers, broken into homes without warrants. And then their leaders have lied about all this.
Lead Pinto, is this relevant to the fraud committee hearing today?
It is, Madam Chair. Yeah, it's very important that we fight fraud, and we absolutely look forward to the hearing today. The concern, Madam Chair, and I'm just wrapping up. We just want to make sure that our neighbors, and I'm assuming for the folks in the majority as well, that our neighbors know that we care and that we are determined to protect their rights and protect our state. Absolutely want to move on with the agenda. It just felt incongruous. As we're here, we want to make sure that our neighbors just recognize that we recognize what's going on and that we're doing all that we can to address it, even as we continue, of course, to address the critical issue of fraud. So I just wanted to make sure that we made that statement before moving on. That's all.
Thank you. Yes, and as I shared with you in the letter that we've exchanged, you are a co-chair of a committee, and you can hold a committee hearing on that at your call. And you can ask for a special session if that's what you desire. But our committee jurisdiction is focused on fraud, and we will continue that work. It's very important to the state that we make sure taxpayer dollars are protected and that our vulnerable citizens are protected. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I would like to welcome our testifiers to the table. Sorry, I lost my agenda here. Commissioner Campbell and Deputy Commissioner Raton, Assistant Commissioner Paul Moore, and Director of Enterprise Workforce Development, Dori Leland, all from the Department of Management and Budget. We appreciate you joining us today and look forward to your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Robbins and members of the Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Policy Committee. My name is Erin Campbell. I'm the Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an overview.
Pardon me one moment. I'm not sure your mic is working.
Oh, okay. Does it just need to be closer?
Oh, maybe. Perfect.
Okay.
Would you mind starting again? State your name. Thank you.
Sure. Sorry about that. Good morning, Chair Robbins and committee. For the record, I'm Erin Campbell, and I serve as the Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an overview to the committee on Minnesota Management and Budget statutory duties and our role in managing the state's finances. As part of this overview, we will talk about MMB's role in supporting agencies' efforts to prevent, identify, and report fraud. I want to begin by saying that fraud of any kind is unacceptable. As we've seen, there are criminals who are constantly looking for ways to take advantage of state systems. The theft perpetrated by these criminals wrongly diverts taxpayer money away from those who need it most, and it erodes trust in our public institutions. The traditional systems that have put in place to administer our public assistance programs have not been sufficient to prevent and identify fraud. This committee and the public are rightly upset by that, and so am I. These systems represent statutes, processes, policies, culture at agencies, practices, IT systems that have been developed over decades. Unfortunately, there's not a silver bullet to stop the type of fraud that we've seen in our public assistance programs. State government is about as complex an enterprise as it gets in terms of the range of functions and its legal regulations. By design, it relies on a decentralized structure of state agencies to carry out its functions and services to the public. To address fraud systematically and enterprise-wide requires layers of coordinated activities, increased controls and security, better use of data, and changes to state statute. Things like laws that set appropriate requirements for provider eligibility for entities to receive state funding, investments in complicated and outdated IT systems to provide data analysis and data sharing, the authority for agencies to suspend payments when fraud is suspected and to prevent those suspected of fraud in one program from receiving money in another, solid internal controls and system security, an unyielding focus on program integrity at state agencies and across the enterprise, coordinated activities between state agencies, law enforcement like the BCA and counties, and thorough oversight by agencies administering programs and services to ensure that providers are legitimate and performing as needed and expected. Important work is underway to tackle these issues within agencies and through interagency efforts, for instance, the OIG Coordinating Council. And MMB is committed to working collaboratively with state agencies to improve oversight of public funds. Just a bit of background here about MMB. The legislature created Minnesota Management and Budget in 2009, and that was after the merger of the Department of Finance, the Department of Employee Relations, and the Management Analysis and Development Team that was originally located at the Department of Administration. The merger created an agency that's focused on budget, finance, and personnel management for Minnesota state government. Since then, the legislature has also invested in a results management unit within our budget services division, and that's focused on evaluating and improving the efficacy of our state programs. And in 2023, the legislature also established a long-term planning division within the department. As you can see on the slide, MMB is a relatively small agency. To put this into perspective, in state government, there are over 100 state departments, agencies, boards, and commissions that are established by the legislature. There's approximately 59,000 state employees across the executive, judicial, and legislative branches carrying out the missions of those agencies, and a total budget of over $65 billion in fiscal year 2025. So we support large state government enterprise with 371 employees, and that's approximately 0.6% of the state workforce. Yet our work does touch every dollar, agency, and position in state government in one way or another. If we just look at the finance-focused parts of the agency, accounting services, internal controls, and debt management have a total of about 90 employees. That's about 24% of our workforce. Budget services and results has another 60 employees, or about 16% of our workforce. And then we've got the employee insurance and enterprise employee resources team. That accounts for about 118 employees, or about 32% of our workforce. And the other 28% of the organization performs duties such as economic analysis. They're members of the management analysis and development team, the planning policy team, and they're doing the central operations of our agency. This next slide is a list of the MMB commissioner's duties that are identified in statute. In this slide, we focus on the duties in 16A.055, which relates to the interests of this committee, I think. I effectively serve with the aid of a small but very dedicated staff as the state's controller, treasurer, and chief financial officer, as well as the state's chief human resources officer. We are keeping track of monies that are coming into and out of the state and its bank accounts. We control funds to limit spending to the amounts appropriated by the legislature. We are making sure that we have enough money to pay our bills, and we are also, importantly, maximizing the state's return on the dollars on hand through timely transfers to the State Board of Investment. We maintain the state's accounts following generally accepted government accounting principles, and we manage the state's uniform accounting system. We work to make sure the state funds are accounted for within the financial reporting framework that's established by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. And we work very closely with state agencies across the enterprise in all of these efforts. They make the spending decisions for their agencies in accordance with the legislative appropriations and authority and oversee the administration of their programs and services. We make sure the state has money to pay for them and that those payments are tracked to the appropriate appropriations. So this slide tells you a little bit about what our authority is. The rest of this presentation will outline how we fulfill these obligations, as well as our work in internal controls and audit, and our efforts to comply with recent executive orders. So with that, Chair Robbins, I'd like to introduce MMB Assistant Commissioner Paul Moore to walk you through our accounting services divisions.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Chair Robbins, members of the committee. My name is Paul Moore. I am MMB's Assistant Commissioner of Accounting Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the important work of MMB's Accounting Services Division. I have the privilege of leading a team of 75 professionals. They include accountants, financial systems experts, payroll specialists, training and communication staff, and customer service representatives. Their work touches every corner of state government, and the functions they perform are organized under several distinct sections within our division that I would like to walk through with you in the next few slides. The first slide here provides a high-level overview of the division's role in the state enterprise. The work across the sections of our division vary considerably. But our division's common purpose is to support efficient and reliable financial management across state government. We carry out statewide comptroller and banking functions, and we provide the enterprise financial systems and services that state agencies rely on. That includes the functional support of some key aspects of the state's ERP technology, specifically the statewide financial integrated tools system, that's SWIFT, state accounting system, as well as the payroll components of the statewide employee management system, also known as Semaphore. We also develop and maintain statewide policies and procedures that guide consistent financial practices across government. Additionally, we directly perform key compliance activities on behalf of the state as a whole, including uniform accounting, funds availability, reconciliations, the state's tax compliance, and other specific compliance activities prescribed to the state government in state statutes as well as in federal regulations. Taken all together, these responsibilities form the financial management infrastructure for state government. All right, transitioning to the first section of our division, banking services. This is the team consisting of six employees responsible for managing the state's cash flow and making sure the state has funds on a daily basis to make good on the payments that have been authorized by state agencies. As part of this work, they oversee and control state payment files so that we know exactly on a daily basis, actually multiple times a day, how much money is leaving the state treasury, and that those payment files tie back to the state's accounting records. They also work multiple times a day with employees at the State Board of Investment to position cash and move money between the state's bank accounts and our investments to ensure we are maximizing short-term investments on the state's dollars. They control the sweep of excess balances in the state's hundreds of bank accounts, over 600 state bank accounts in the state. and they consolidate those balances to facilitate that cash positioning and payment processing I just spoke to. They reconcile at least monthly the 600-plus state bank account statements to our SWIFT accounting records. Reconciling bank statements to your bookkeeping is essential for any private or public entity. It tells an organization how much cash we have available, finds discrepancies, and it supports the accurate reporting of the state's cash asset account in our financial statements. In addition, this team also supports credit card and electronic payment services and products that agencies can use to support the payments with the public and their customers. Moving on to our statewide accounting section, that consists of 13 employees. This team is responsible for the state's general accounting and financial reporting. These are core functions that ensure the state's financial activity is recorded accurately and consistently across the enterprise. This section also likes to remind me regularly that they are under external audit for 9 months out of the year. They maintain the state's chart of accounts in our accounting system. Those are over 4,000 asset and income statement accounts used by state agencies to record their financial activity in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. That structure is essential for producing reliable financial information. The section also completes the centralized reconciliations and accounting entries that keep the state's books accurate. Their financial foundational controls that support transparency and consistency across state government and consistency with our financial statements with those of other governments. Each year, this team produces the annual comprehensive financial report that's known by the acronym the ACFR. In accordance with those generally accepted accounting principles, it's the state's audited financial report, audited by the Office of Legislative Auditor. It's one of the most significant financial compliance responsibilities of our division. They also implement new accounting standards. So generally accepted accounting principles are set by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board standard-setting body. Those are applicable to all state and local governments. These standards are very complex at times. And when new standards are released, it requires significant work and coordination across state agencies to ensure consistent application. In addition, statewide accounting provides the financial reporting components of the single audit, which is a key federal compliance requirement of the state and any entity receiving federal awards. Finally, they administer the statewide cost allocation plan, also known as the SWACAP. That supports the state's ability to maximize federal awards so that the federal fund pays its fair share of the state's operations costs. Together, these responsibilities form the backbone of the state's uniform accounting framework, and they fulfill our major financial reporting and compliance requirements. The work of our next section, the SWIFT system support section, I'll be addressing in the next two slides. This slide is dedicated to our vendor payment and support functions. The team manages the state's central vendor registration and file maintenance, supporting more than 380,000 vendor profiles in the SWIFT supplier portal. They also provide customer service support to our state's vendors and payees who may need assistance with their registrations, maybe tax questions, or if they need to make changes to their profile, or if they've got concerns or questions about payments they're receiving from the state. This is an area where our division and our agency plays a direct and significant role in fraud prevention and mitigation. Like all large enterprises, private or public, the state is facing a significant and increasing in its sophistication vendor impersonation fraud schemes designed to redirect payment to state vendors, or excuse me, to fraud state payments to our vendors, redirect them to fraudsters. Because we centrally maintain the state's vendor records, we centrally authorize bank account changes, and because we centrally process the state's payments, our division is the target of these schemes regularly. And in response, we have built a strong multi-layered anti-fraud program That includes IT system security measures, identity verification methods, personal information validations from those contacting us, and detailed policies and procedures for our division staff, including employee expectations for reviewing and authorizing banking requests and for reporting suspected fraud. We also have employee trainings. We regularly hold team meetings where fraud risks are openly discussed. And we have adopted what's called a zero trust mindset pulled from the IT community, meaning we treat every request that comes through us as if it were fraud. Treat it as legitimate once fully verified. When this team identifies fraud attempts, the incident triggers immediate response efforts overseen by me, Deputy Commissioner Raton, and Commissioner Campbell. This fraud prevention work is critical to protect the state treasury and the state's payees. It also matters because of the scale of our centralized payment function for the state. Each year, our division processes 2.5 million payments for the entirety of the state enterprise. That includes generating electronic payment files, like the automated clearinghouse ACH files, when you receive payments via direct deposit, as well as printing and mailing state warrants. Those have their own legal definition, but you can think of them as paper checks. On a daily basis, this team reconciles warrants presented to financial institutions against our database of what's been authorized and outstanding, and they make final approval or denial decisions accordingly. They also process cancellations, reissuance, and the escheatment of outstanding and stale state warrants to commerce unclaimed property. Finally, this team fulfills statewide tax compliance responsibilities, such as producing thousands of IRS Form 1099s to state payees. In short, protecting the state and our payees against vendor impersonation fraud is an area where our division has direct responsibility, and we have strong proactive steps in place. Moving to the remaining units in the SWIFT system support sections, they provide the functional oversight and support for SWIFT, a PeopleSoft-based financial management system. More than 4,700 users across state government and all three branches of government use SWIFT every day to record their financial activity, process their payments, manage their budgets, and carry out other core business operations. These units deliver trainings, webinars, and reference guides to help users navigate our system effectively. Those resources are essential for maintaining consistent financial practices across the state enterprise. They also operate the statewide systems help desk, responding to approximately 20,000 calls each year from system users, not just SWIFT, but all of the ERP technologies supported by MMB. Another part of this section provides functional expertise for the major financial modules in SWIFT. Some of those modules include budgetary control, accounts receivable and billing, accounts payable, purchasing, and asset management. They make sure these modules function correctly, consistently, and they assist state agency users with often complicated module-specific issues. The section also leads the state's fiscal year close process, which we manage with key support from our budget services division. It is a massive coordinated effort across the state enterprise that takes several months, in which we work with our agency partners to complete their transactions, correct any issues with their accounts or transactions, certify or cancel their outstanding encumbrances, set up appropriations for the next fiscal year, close the books on the fiscal year, roll forward any remaining balances where there's legal authority, or cancel those balances back to the bottom line of the funds, and set up budgets and encumbrances for the next fiscal year. In partnership with our Minute colleagues, this team also provides the functional oversight and testing for system upgrades and other projects. Their work ensures that bugs are identified before our projects go live, and they protect the stability and accuracy of the state's financial system. Finally, the work of this section supports the timely and accurate financial data that is contained in the state's Transparency MN Open Checkbook portal. The application gives Minnesotans access to information about agency appropriations, their budgets, their payments, contracts, grants, and it relies on the data of SWIFT to provide that information to the public. Collectively, these units support a state financial system that is stable, accurate, and usable for the state. In turn, they also support accurate and timely financial information access and analysis for state agencies, the public, and our bondholders and other interested parties. The last section of our division is the statewide payroll services section. The team facilitates the timely and accurate payment of wages to 59,000 state employees in our three branches of government. The section provides the functional support for the payroll components of Semaphore and other PeopleSoft-based system, providing human resource payroll and benefits management technology. Some of the payroll-related Semaphore functionality we support includes timesheet entry and approval, labor distribution across the state's funding sources, direct deposit payments to employees, business expense reimbursements, retroactive pay processing, for example, the implementation of the state's labor contracts and compensation plans, retirement contributions, pre- and post-tax benefits administered through the Employee Group Insurance Program, as well as our state and federal tax responsibilities, such as withholding and remitting payments. Our functional support includes the training and resources for system users and testing of the system for projects. We also centrally process certain payroll processes for the state, such as court garnishments, the payment files from our system to banks, and important reconciliations. Another major responsibility of this section is implementing payroll changes that are required by state and federal law. For example, every year the IRS, as we know, updates mileage reimbursement rates, and that needs to be coded in our systems. This team also fulfills the state's tax compliance obligations as an employer. We remit state and federal tax withholdings. We reconcile withholding and remittance amounts. And we file required quarterly and annual tax forms with the IRS and with state taxing authorities. Earlier this month, this section sent 74,000 W-2s to current or former employees who received wages from from state agencies in calendar year 2025. These various responsibilities serve a broader purpose, that we pay our state employees accurately and on time, and that we meet the state's payroll-related legal obligations as an employer. The final section I would like to highlight is our role in maintaining the statewide financial policies and procedure infrastructure for the state. We have 129 statewide financial policies and procedures, many more dozens of procedures, and then many more dozens of procedures that establish the standards and expectations agencies need to follow to carry out their financial management responsibilities. While not explicitly stated in all of my previous slides and testimony, maintaining and updating the statewide policies and procedures is a key responsibility of every section within the division. Many of those 129 policies are owned by the Accounting Services Division, although some fall under the oversight of Budget Services, Debt Management, and Internal Controls and Accountability areas. This number does not include other statewide financial management policies from the Department of Administration.
Sorry to interrupt, Mr. Moore. We're just half an hour into this, so I just wondered if we could move along a little faster. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Overall, the statewide policies and procedures are foundational to the state's internal control environment, and they are a key way MMB promotes integrity and accountability in state agencies and their programs. I had mentioned internal controls and accountability, and with that, I'd like to transition to Deputy Commissioner Britta Raton to speak to those topics. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Welcome, Ms. Raton.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Robbins and committee members. For the record, I'm Britta Raton, Deputy Commissioner at MMB. And I'm going to speak a bit about MMB's role with internal controls and accountability for the enterprise. The policies and procedures that Mr. Moore was just mentioning, along with state statute, really provide the framework of the internal control system in state government. I appreciate the opportunity to provide an overview of how we implement statute through the efforts of our MMB Internal Control and Accountability Unit. In doing so, I'm going to summarize some of the key highlights of our recent activities of this unit and the strategies we use to promote and protect public assets and to foster a culture of compliance across the executive branch. So the internal controls team serves as a resource for the executive branch, offering tools to help agencies strengthen their internal controls, identify and address risks, and promote compliance with applicable statutes and policies. This team is guided by the U.S. Government Accountability Office Green Book. And the mission of this team is to promote strong internal controls environments across state government through collaboration, continuous improvement, and strategic initiatives. The work of this team is managed by our Director of Internal Controls and Accountability and a staff that includes both internal controls specialists and a recently implemented internal audit team. We did not have internal audit staff as part of this team until 2023. So I'm going to walk through some of our primary strategies here. So MMB provides agencies tools in order to assess their internal controls and their risk. MMB requires agencies to complete a control system assessment tool annually. And this is a resource that aligns with the U.S. Government Accountability Office Green Book and focuses on 15 organizational goals across five key components of the framework. So agencies use this control system assessment to evaluate their compliance, document whether they have strengths or weaknesses, and then document corrective actions that they plan to take if they need to strengthen an internal control. Subject matter experts and agency management are expected to collaborate to strengthen internal controls, ensuring alignment with their strategic objectives and fostering their operational effectiveness. So the control system assessment tool is a structured way for agency heads and managers to annually discuss and document the presence and effectiveness of internal controls in many important common areas across the enterprise, including contracting, grant making, reporting, accounting practices, as well as in areas such as hiring, payroll, and management of IT systems. Assessing internal controls can help identify areas of strength and areas for improvement. Importantly, and as part of the statute, the agency head then signs off on a certification form. The statute clearly states that the agency head is responsible for the internal controls within their agency, and they sign the form that they have reviewed the internal controls framework in their own agency's internal controls and are signing off on those controls. Agencies also complete a risk assessment, which helps them identify, prioritize, and mitigate risks and track progress on their projects. Some examples of projects agencies have planned include IT system access and security projects, reviewing compliance with OGM policies, updating continuity plans, updating their own policies and procedures. The risk assessment allows staff to identify new risks requiring attention and ensure continued strategic alignment of internal resources. Key focus areas in this space often include cybersecurity, data management, and grants management. So the agency risk assessment is a template that allows agency personnel to assess and document agency risk and have agency senior leadership review that information and be part of those discussions annually. Agency senior leadership is responsible for the projects included on that plan. I also want to note that in 2025, the GAO provided updates to their green book related to fraud prevention and improper payments. So we will be modifying our risk assessment tools and CSATs to reflect these changes at the federal level as well. Another strategy that this team engages in is reviewing and working with agencies to resolve internal control issues identified by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Our team works with agencies to help them develop and implement corrective action plans to resolve findings efficiently and effectively, and our team tracks resolution to those audit findings on a document that we call the Corrective Action Plan Status Update. This information is requested from agencies twice a year, and the internal control team is also available to provide consultation, training, and other resources to assist agencies in resolving those issues. We also meet with agency leadership if they have outstanding unresolved audit findings that they are involved that involve their agency to make sure that they are tracking those unresolved audit findings and working with their teams to get to resolution. I also want to note in the last year, we've implemented a common response template for agencies to OLA reports in order to ensure clarity and standardization in how we track audit findings. By proactively monitoring findings across reporting cycles, we're enhancing accountability and supporting agencies in long-term success. Important in this template is that we have all agencies list the detailed steps that they will take as part of the corrective action, who will be responsible for that, and by when that will be complete. I also want to highlight the training and assistance work that this team does. The Internal Control and Accountability Unit is committed to empowering agency personnel with tools and knowledge to strengthen internal controls. The unit regularly presents internal controls concepts at the Supervisor and Manager Corps sessions. Supervisor and Manager Corps are for all new supervisors and managers in state government. So during 2025, the unit trained 554 new supervisors and 236 new managers to state government. The trainings include basic internal control information, the roles that managers and supervisors have in ensuring that their teams have effective internal controls in place, and also an overview of fraud theory and what managers should do to prevent fraud from occurring. This information is presented to supervisors and managers in a variety of ways through case studies and real-world examples, as well as opportunities to test their knowledge in the course. I also want to talk about the Code of Ethical Conduct. The state has a Code of Ethical Conduct for all employees, and all employees are required to complete an annual Code of Ethical Conduct training aimed at reinforcing those ethical standards. This also covers fraud prevention practices, and it's administered annually. It really focuses on the acceptance of gifts, use of confidential information, use of state property of time or time, conflict of interest, non-retaliation, and some basics on internal controls. The internal controls team also hosts the annual Fraud Awareness Week every year for the state enterprise. In 2025, the event was our largest yet. We had sessions offered to state employees every day. In many of our sessions, we'd had upwards of 800 folks in attendance. Presentations included information from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension discussing emerging fraud trends. Minnesota Department of Health was focused on how to integrate fraud prevention into daily work and practices and the importance of professional skepticism. And the Twin Cities Association of Certified Fraud Examiners presented on fraud awareness in the public sector. Unfortunately, due to the federal government shutdown, we needed to cancel some of the presentations for that week. We did kind of hustle and get some other presentations set up, but we hope to bring back our federal agency partners in the near future to give some trainings from the federal level as well. And then the Internal Controls and Accountability Unit also publishes a series of one-page bulletins on topics such as risk assessment, ethics, compensating controls, which are quick and easy kind of actionable things for agency personnel to read and apply. And then lastly for this team, the Internal Controls and Accountability team also hosts a community of practice across state government, which brings together internal auditors and internal controls professionals from across state government to discuss best practices, share insights, and collaborate on enterprise-wide initiatives.
Thank you. This is taking a long time. I think we provided guidance about 25 minutes for your presentation. We are well over that. We still have one more presenter. So if you could please try to speed it up. We have a lot of questions, so we'd like
Certainly.
To get to that. Thank you.
I will try to move really quick through this next session. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the previous slides covered our normal business processes and the work products that we do. Now I want to cover the work that MMB has been involved in with response to the current fraud issues facing the state. First off, last session, MMB worked with the legislature to obtain additional authority for agencies to withhold payments when there's evidence of fraud. This session, we will be coming back with suggested revisions to that language to, one, remove the sunset on that language, two, to lower the evidentiary threshold for when we can withhold payment, and to allow payment withholdings to an entity if fraud is discovered in one program but they are a participant in another. MMB is also working as part of the Governor's Executive Order 2510 with a group of agencies on an interagency work group. It includes DHS, DCYF, MDE, DEED, DPS, Department of Administration, Revenue, and MINUTE. And this group is really focused on the shared challenges that cut across agencies to break down silos and enable the state to use collective knowledge to prevent fraud more quickly and to identify potentially fraudulent entities. To support this work, the group is also engaging national experts, including Director Tim O'Malley and a consultant called Waypoint, to bring evidence-informed practices into Minnesota's approach. The work is really organized around key areas of data sharing and use, technology systems, policies, tools, and workforce training. It's really first focused on the highest risk and highest impact areas. I'm trying to move quickly here. One thing that I want to call out as a part of this effort, MMB has also deployed data scientists to DHS. These data scientists are from our results team, and they are deployed to help strengthen data-driven approaches to identifying anomalous provider behavior more quickly. This work is improving Medicaid investigations and generating practical lessons that MMB and DHS are now sharing with other agencies to support broader use of data to identify fraud patterns and strengthen enforcement efforts. Overall, I'll kind of breeze quickly through this next part, but the work of this group is really, as I was mentioning, focused on identifying common tools, technology, and workforce training needs across agencies that we can focus on in both the short term and the longer term to improve the state's fraud response and prevention efforts.
And thank you, Ms. Leland. And perhaps you could just provide an overview rather than go through each slide in detail. Thank you.
Of course,
please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I promise to be the briefest of all of the MMB presenters. My name is Dory Leland. I'm the Enterprise Director for Enterprise Workforce Development. And relevant to this committee, in that capacity, I oversee the state's job classification system as well as Enterprise Talent Development, our employee enterprise training division. The Executive Order 2510 included three components that fell under the auspices of the Workforce Development Division. I won't read them. They're here on the slide. I will not read them to you in the interest of time. The first of those was to create all employee fraud prevention training. We had a good base of this to start because we were already in the process of creating additional fraud awareness training for our managers and supervisors. Where we're at right now is that we're taking the components of that in-process training that are relevant to all employees. We have worked on it internally at MMB. We're working with subject matter experts throughout the enterprise to make sure that that training is relevant. And in the next couple of weeks, I'm also going to be reaching out to confirm with Mr. O'Malley and with the Office of the Legislative Auditor that this training is relevant and helpful in terms of what all employees need to know in terms of fraud prevention. Second, part of this executive order asked us to look at job classifications. Where we're at with that is that we have surveyed agencies. They sent us 700 descriptions of different types of work that employees within agencies across 21 agencies were doing in the areas of auditing, internal controls, and inspection. We've identified kind of 50 benchmarks of people that do that work full-time, and we are in the process of scheduling hay evaluations to further evaluate how to make those into their own specific job family related to program integrity work. Finally, we are developing job-specific training. So within those job classifications and that job family that's going to be created, we have identified some key skills and competencies that are necessary for somebody to be successful in those roles. And we're going to be creating training that all employees within those roles are required to take, irrespective of the agency that they work for. And so if you have an internal a role in internal audit at DOT or DHS or MDH, wherever it is you work, you will have at least some baseline required training that MMB will offer to complement whatever training is also being done at the agency level related to whatever grants or programs they oversee.
Thank you. Ms. Campbell.
I'll wrap it up here by saying thank you for the time today to present to you. I hope that it's evident from our testimony that we take our obligations very seriously and work hard to, within the scope of our authority, to make sure that every dollar that passes through our agency reaches its intended beneficiary and is accounted for. And so with that, happy to take any questions.
Yes, I think we have many. Let's start with Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just as a point of logistics for our hearing today, we're going to spend time with Commissioner Campbell and her team, and then we'll be getting an additional presentation in a little bit?
Yes, from Department of Admin.
Okay, yes. Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I don't assume that you have spent the last several months watching each and every one of these hearings, and yet over the last several months since the legislative session, hundreds of millions of dollars of fraud, known tangible fraud in Minnesota has taken place. In addition, just in the last 2 months, we have spelled out in this committee how fraudsters have continued to receive state funds. In addition, we have seen how an entire web presented by Chair Robbins is able to show how agencies aren't communicating. In addition, we have seen viral videos talk about the issues of program integrity and fraud across our state agencies. As our state's top financial officer, how do you respond to these things that have happened?
Ms. Campbell.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, as I said, we are very concerned about fraud in the state of Minnesota for a number of reasons. The work that Minnesota Management and Budget does, as we've described to you in maybe too much detail, is really about how we create systems of financial management across state agencies. We then rely on agencies to manage those systems. That is increasingly complex in this environment. Fraudsters are getting more and more innovative, we really need to make sure that we've got the right environment in every agency to adapt to that changing environment. That means that we need to have we need to be set up for success, and we're not always set up for success. We might not have the IT system capabilities or improvements that we need. We might not have adequate staffing. We might have legislation that doesn't set a high enough barrier to entry, you know, and we might not have all of the internal controls in state agencies that we need in order to make sure that there's strong financial management. And so we work as hard as we can to support agencies in doing that work, understanding that it is their responsibility to implement.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You have very broad statutory authority and responsibility, and you mentioned it, but I can't understate it how frustrated Minnesotans are right now with the level of fraud and the lack of accountability that we've seen. That frustration, I need to verbalize directly to you. Minnesotans are so frustrated, especially when moments ago, Assistant Commissioner Moore said that through the SWIFT system, through your accounting system, you know who you're paying. You know the people who you are sending money to. You know their name, you know their business. Frankly, you probably know who they're connected to. And through the tools across state agencies and across all of the executive branch, from business registrations to what they have to file with the Attorney General's office, all of those tools exist. So why are payments continuing to people who have been convicted of fraud?
Ms. Campbell.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, MMB has limited line of sight into the payments that are made across state government. We can see things like the payee, the dollar amount, the funding source, the agency that it is associated with. What we don't know is whether or not the terms of whatever agreement these payees have with the state have been met, whether or not we certainly don't have any sense of who they are connected to, who the payees are connected to. We don't know if it's the payments have been made within its statutory authority. You've heard through this presentation that MMB has a staff of, it's ultimately 75 people on Paul's team that work on financial management, supporting an organization that has a budget of $65 billion, that has 59,000 state employees, hundreds of state agencies, boards, and commissions, where we're making 2.5 million payments every year. We do not have the capacity at our agency or the appropriate line of sight to be able to make those determinations.
Last one, Ms. Representative.
You know, thank you, Madam Chair. I do have many other questions, but I'll defer. And I'll just say this. 59,000 state employees, and yet hundreds of millions of dollars, and just in the last several months, that this committee has talked about. That's not to talk about the $9 billion worth of likely Medicaid fraud. This is outrageous for the people of Minnesota that our state government, at its largest size in state history, can't take care of this mess.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask a question following on that. You said that you create systems and rely on the agencies to manage those systems. And in a different part, we talked about how the agencies are required to do this sign-off on internal controls. And so I just wondered, if you're setting up sort of all these templates and all these processes, and then the agency heads sign off on it, but indeed, within those agencies, there's rampant fraud, as we have seen. When they sign off on it, how do you hold them accountable? So for example, in DHS, all the rampant fraud, or in Department of Ed, when we had all the Feeding Our Future fraud, or in Ag, where with the SNAP fraud, when these agency heads sign off, and yet there's indictments, convictions, known fraud, what do you do to hold them accountable?
Madam Chair, we do not have the way that we are able to do this work is by supporting state agencies. I know that there's the general impression that MMB can make people do anything. That's not true. We don't have any. This is not an area where we have delegated authority, for example. We don't we don't have the stick that you're referencing. And so what we do is work hard to support them, to provide them the tools and resources, to set them up for success along the way. Is there anything you'd want to add?
Sure. And
Ms. Vrijten.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think an important piece of this is what we're really seeing is this fraud happening in our social service systems. And this work group that we're discussing is really looking at how do we do better on the front of data sharing and data analytics to identify trends. I think what we're seeing is fraud happening in places where it is frankly more difficult to verify that the service is in fact being provided because it's off site. Its site visits may not be adequate, which is what we would typically rely upon. In some cases, licensing is a barrier, and that licensing piece can help. But in this work group, a lot of our discussion is really turning to what more can we do with data systems and data analytics? And that really needs to be an enterprise-wide effort in data sharing and data analytics to help identify anomalous behaviors so that our agencies that run these large programs that are kind of programs with lots of providers and lots of folks being served, their OIGs aren't kind of looking for that needle in a haystack, but instead being able to look at a smaller set of data that is pulled based on anomalous activity. And I really think that is an important piece, is making sure we're getting agencies the right tools to do their work in a more modern era.
That raises so many questions. So you view your role as supporting agencies to do their job, but not holding them accountable. Am I understanding that?
Madam Chair, we do not have a tool to hold agencies accountable.
So what would that tool be? What do you need? Because under statute, that is your responsibility for internal controls. So if you don't have the tools and it's yet your statutory responsibility, like, what do you need?
I want to be clear, Madam Chair, I want to be clear that when you look at the state statute, and I know that Britta mentioned this, subdivision 8 of 16A.057 specifically states that the head of each executive agency is responsible for designing, implementing, and maintaining an effective internal control system within the agency that complies with the requirements of the subdivisions. What we probably need, ultimately, I mean, I know you're asking the question of what do we need to hold agencies accountable? I would view that differently, and that would be to say, what do we need for agencies to be successful in doing this? And I think because there is ultimately the responsibility of state agencies to manage their own internal controls, what they need is the appropriate training and staffing in order to make sure that they've got good and strong internal controls across state government. And that it's more than just internal controls. It's also about program integrity, which I think that's an important part of this conversation as well. We're focused on internal controls, financial management. There are other elements to preventing fraud that are beyond those two items, things like program integrity and others.
Okay, I would just like to point out that in statute 16A.057, it says the commissioner, meaning of MMB, is responsible for the system of internal controls across the executive branch. Sub 1, safeguard public funds and assess and assets and minimize incidents of fraud, waste, and abuse. That is the responsibility of the commissioner of MMB.
And Chair Robbins, the way that we do that is by creating a framework for agencies to use and providing support and resources and tools for them to use in order to identify and implement their own internal controls.
And when they fail at that, what do you do?
Go ahead.
Chair Robbins, what we do is step in with support. So this work group is a example of that. If there is gaps in internal controls, we have folks that can come in and help agencies look at how to improve those internal controls. We can provide trainings and more information. We can help them work through OLA audit findings. And what I'm talking about on this systems front is kind of a step further, is realizing that we are in an environment now where we need tools that are more robust and more advanced than we currently have in some of our large-scale programs. The other thing that I think we can do that was referenced by Ms. Leland earlier is make sure we have that agencies have the tools to hire the right staff at the right level in order to help them achieve success.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what we've hearing today is the agencies, MMB sets out guidelines, even though they're statutory responsible for ensuring integrity, they're essentially agency heads themselves are responsible for their overall integrity and of internal controls. And when it happens, there's nothing that you can do about it, which I believe, actually, that there's nothing you can do about it. Because ultimately, well, who's responsible is the governor. It is the governor's office who hires these agency heads, who has to hold all of the staff and the agency heads and your own department accountable. I sit on the audit commission. I've spent last several years watching bad audit after bad audit, except for the Attorney General's office, by the way. They had a good audit. But every agency that we have seen, including the governor's office, which I think had 14 findings. I can't even remember. It was crazy. Every single one has had issues. And they have things that were unresolved. The exact same findings from the audit that was 3 years earlier. They're not resolved. So the problem is a culture in this administration of irresponsibility and a lack, severe lack of internal controls all the way from the top. So I agree with the commissioner, and I, you know, as you know, ran part of your old agency a long time ago, okay, that you don't have the authority to force other commissioners to do the right thing. Only the governor has the authority to do that. And in every administration in the history of the state, I have never seen anything like what's been happening in state government, where we have bad actors, we have bad internal controls, we have people, frankly, that went after, including legislators, going after the Office of the Legislative Auditor because of findings. That is just wrong, really, really wrong. And I think as finance professionals, you would understand that and agree with that. I have one, I guess, others question. We have 4,700 SWIFT users. 8% of the workforce has access into the payment system. Is that accurate? I think so. 4,750, according to your...
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Representative Anderson, that is correct. There are 4,700 users of the SWIFT accounting system. As I had already mentioned, we processed state agencies, processed 2.5 million payments a year. That does not include all of the other financial management transactions that occur in the state accounting system. That totals 74 million transactions a year in the state accounting system. MMB maintains the policy and procedure and infrastructure for the segregation of duties and security roles in the SWIFT system.
Thank you,
yes.
Chair. So do all 4,700 have authority to authorize payments?
No.
How many people have authority to do
that? Mr. Moore.
Chair, would
approve. Approve.
Would be happy to get back to you with those statistics. I don't have them off the top of my head. In the accounting system, there are voucher entry and then a voucher approval frameworks. There are multiple layers of control in the state accounting system, separating the functions of voucher entry, voucher approval, and even in the voucher approval framework for certain payments of certain sizes. There are further segregation of duties and multiple layers of control.
Thank you. For lack of time.
Yes, thank you. All right, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the folks at MMB. And I know as we are talking about this, and I really appreciate the framework that Chair Robbins started with about our job being to protect taxpayer dollars, to make sure that taxpayer dollars are protected and vulnerable citizens are protected. And I think that is what we have spent the last year talking about. And I know that you all really are the ones who keep track of and the flow in and out of federal money coming into the state, which both impacts folks on the ground, our vulnerable citizens who rely on programs, and also impacts our ability to provide the oversight detection and prosecution of when fraud targets our public programs. So I am wondering, you know, what since Trump's Operation Metro Surge, he has used the pretense of fraud in addition to inundating our communities with masked and armed federal agents, which we're not talking about here today. Also used it to issue orders trying to deny our state and these programs and Minnesotans resources under the guise of fraud, which is why we should be talking about it. Child care assistance, Medicaid assistance. And I actually think it would be useful from your perspective to just get a sense of what are the programs that we have seen, what is the funding programs we have seen targeted, and what is the current status? Because I know there has been some things that the Trump administration has tried to do that have been held up in court, so maybe we're not feeling it. But it would be helpful to have, under the guise of fraud, what are the federal resources that either have been threatened or are not currently coming into the state, just to detail that. And then I have a follow-up question.
Ms. Campbell.
Chair Robbins, I may actually ask our state budget director, Anna Mingi, to join me at the table, who's been tracking the impacts of the federal funding reductions that we've that have materialized and that could materialize in those impacts.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Mingi. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Anna Mingi, state budget director at Minnesota Management and Budget. So as you may be aware, with the budget division within MMB, it contains the federal funding implementation team, whose job is to track and coordinate federal funding across state government. Starting in late November, several federal awarding agencies, specifically the Administration for Children and Families, the United States Department of Agriculture, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, have sent letters to various state agencies and the governor indicating they'd be freezing select programs. So we've received many letters. A few significant funding streams I'd highlight would include the Child Care Development Fund, where we're budgeting to receive about $180 million this year. The funding from the United States Department of Agriculture, including SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Program, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which is the federal block grant that supports the Minnesota Family Investment Program, you know, many, as well as other USDA funding streams. We've received other letters questioning other programs within federal agencies. Because of court action, many of the pro funding streams from the Administration for Children and Families are currently flowing. So, including the children of the Child Care Development Fund, those funds actually weren't flowing until yesterday. We were notified that they would turn them back on again. We are operating under a preliminary injunction for SNAP administrative funding. And then our TANF fund are also flowing thanks to a temporary restraining order from the judicial branch.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you describe from that, like, I've heard a number. It'd be helpful to hear sort of the total number of funds that have put at risk that are going to Minnesotans under this pretense of fraud. And then maybe if you know the impact that these funds are having, both on the individual Minnesotans, but also on these programs and the government agencies' ability to provide the oversight and detection and prosecution of fraud that we in this committee are paying attention to.
Ms. Bingy.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, I think one of the big challenges in interpreting these letters from the federal government is often they're unclear about when things will start and when they stop. But if we look just on like an annual basis, we're talking hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. For example, we were notified of the federal government's intent to withhold $515 million per calendar quarter for our Medicaid program. And in that case, if the state loses $550 million a quarter, which translates to $2 billion a year, that's not something that the state budget can just absorb without impacts. So that's something that would result in pressures on state agencies, restriction in administrative funding opportunities, which would affect our ability to administer state programs. I'd also note really specifically the Child Care Development Fund, which I mentioned a minute ago, directly funds 11 staff within the Department of Children, Youth, and Families Office of Inspector General. So that's a direct impact of if those funds do stop flowing, that work would be unable to continue without a state appropriation to backfill it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you.
On the list,
yeah,
thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate you providing all of us the ability to talk about this. And I guess just taking from that, like $515 million a quarter potentially that is being threatened, that I think because court injunctions we have, I think it is important to remember that what we are here to do is protect what Chair Robbins said, taxpayer dollars and those vulnerable citizens. And what we are seeing and the reason we actually need to be talking about what the federal government is doing is that the arbitrary actions under the pretense of fraud are actually making it harder for our agencies to oversee and detect and prosecute fraud. Additionally, we have seen, I know you all love to cite news stories, but yesterday CARE 11 had a news story about how what happened on our streets after the killing of Renick Good, what happened in the U.S. Attorney's Office is actually going to make it very hard for the U.S. Attorney's Office that you all often cite as a critical partner to prosecute and continue to do the work because we are losing so much institutional talent. We also heard in those stories about how hard it is given what is currently happening in Minnesota to keep our attention on the important work of protecting our services against the fraudsters who are trying to take them. The last thing I will say, and I think we need to talk about that in this committee, and I know you all don't like to talk about anything that has to do with the federal government, but the federal government has brought their boot here in my communities and in our state government, and we have to talk about that. The third thing is that in the last, 10 days, 7 days since the president promised reckoning and retribution, he has pardoned at least 7 Medicaid fraudsters. And I will not, in the interest of time, read all of them and what they were pardoned for, but wire fraud, honest services fraud, security fraud.
Thank you.
And so if we are serious about prosecuting fraud, we also have to be serious about the sentencing matter. And so what I would like to make sure that we are doing here is taking seriously the real federal threat to our work prosecuting fraud, to our work detecting fraud, and that we're also talking about not just putting folks in jail, which the Attorney General's office has done and the U.S. Attorney's office has done, but also making sure that we have a culture that actually treats fraud seriously. And right now we don't with President Trump and Operation Metro Surge.
I absolutely agree. We need a culture that takes fraud seriously. And I will get to Representative Schultz in 1 second, but that raises a question for me. So one of the issues about the relationship with the federal government is that when we have high SNAP error rates, when we have billions in overpayments millions, I should say, millions in overpayments. That the overpayments are due every year. And if we don't pay them within a year, we are accruing interest. So can you talk about two buckets, like how the SNAP error rate is going to cost us $86 million potentially, and the overpayments, what is the, if you don't have it at your fingertips, I would like a list of the every year, the annual amount in overpayments that we have to pay back to the federal government and what we are paying in interest on that. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, to the second question, we would need to follow up with the committee after and work with our colleagues at the Department of the DCYF and DHS to answer the question. You're correct that since the passage of H.R. 1, the federal reconciliation bill this summer, states will, for the first time, have a sort of a non-federal share for the portion for SNAP benefits based on their payment error rate. The based on our error rate sort of in previous years, that would put Minnesota at about a 10% local share, which is sort of $80 to $90 million a year. There are significant efforts underway across the administration to reduce the payment error rate. I would sort of want my colleagues at DCYF to present to you on all the work that they're doing there, but that is a pressure that we are certainly tracking.
Thank you, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate your comments, and I also agree, and I want to appreciate the members on the other side of the aisle who are saying that this is a real and significant problem that deserves federal and state and local level attention. Minnesotans are sick of this. And for too long, it's been hidden inside this state capitol. For too long, but not any longer. So, Commissioner, you mentioned earlier, and in your statutory authority, you are essentially the top human resources officer of the state of Minnesota. Whistleblowers have spoken to this committee. They've spoken to the Attorney General's office. They have spoken to countless different people within state government, including inspectors general. What have you done with the whistleblower reports that you and your agency have received?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I am aware of, so first and foremost, let me tell you that the Code of Ethics strictly prohibits retaliation in the workplace. If that is an issue someplace, I wish somebody would tell me because we will follow up and address that issue. So I want to be really clear, retaliation is not tolerated. I am aware of only one instance in which somebody has come forward to MMB and actually via the legislative auditor with a concern about, you know, whistleblowing. And in that case, it was not in my role as commissioner. It was in my role as the deputy commissioner for enterprise employee resources. We dealt with the HR elements of that those complaints. It was my understanding that the OLA was dealing with some of the other pieces. And we followed up and looked into the matters and dealt with the issues that we could.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be hopefully my final question on this because I know we have more to get to here today. Has the governor ever directed you or members of your team to stifle the reports of whistleblowers?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, absolutely not.
Thank you. Very quickly, Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I just want to follow up to Representative Greenman's comments about the feds. So we have the head of MMB who says that they can't hold anyone accountable, the other commissioners, the other agencies, which they can't because you can't terminate or discipline another commissioner as a commissioner. So we have agency heads themselves who aren't, doing the job clearly. They're allowing fraud. They're not dealing with internal controls. We have problems all over state government. We have a governor's office that's doing nothing with the agency heads that are problems. with any of this stuff. In fact, his own office is poor. And so you have to have something, someone besides us as a committee that comes in and deals with the fraud. And these are heavy, heavy, heavy federal dollars. And so I welcome what's happening with the feds coming in into DHS, forcing changes, forcing them, which they're happening now because the feds are withholding or threatening to withhold dollars. Because these are dollars that are going to fraudsters. And it is too bad that this state got to the point where we had to have the feds come in to make any sort of changes. But that is what's happening. And I hope we can get our act together. I hope that this changes things around, and maybe it will. You know, if it doesn't, we are going to lose a significant amount of money, and the people in Minnesota are going to suffer. So thank you.
We're going to invite the Commissioner of Administration, Tamara Granvall, up, and her staff, and Representative Greenman, if you wanted to give a quick response while they're coming, that would be great.
I appreciate what you're saying, Representative Anderson. One, you didn't mention the Attorney General's office, which we've all heard punches above their weight and actually works with the CMS. But what I also didn't hear you say is address the fact that there are hundreds of millions of dollars, not only that won't be going to individuals, that will not be going to provide oversight and provide these prosecutions. And so when you say, I invite and I'm looking forward to the feds, these are the same feds and the same bosses who are the reason that Joe Thompson left the U.S. Attorney's office. So I agree. I think we need to be doing everything and anything we can, focus on protecting Minnesotans and taxpayer dollars, as Chair Robbins said. I don't think there's any evidence that the Trump administration and Operation Retro Surge is actually doing that. And that's what I think we should be talking about.
All right, let's move on to Commissioner Granvall. Please introduce yourself for the record. And I know, I think we told you 20 minutes, but we don't have 20 minutes. So if you can do a high level, we have a lot of questions for you as well. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Tamar Granvall. I'm the commissioner at the Department of Administration. And with me today is Deputy Stacy Christensens. My remarks will be brief, and then I'll turn it over to our subject matter expert, Deputy Christensens. This slide provides a very high overview of the grants landscape in Minnesota. State grants are financial assistance paid or services furnished by a state agency via a third party to an eligible recipient. Grants are issued in the form of a grant contract agreement. Minnesota has a decentralized state grant management system, which means that grant-making authority, decision-making, implementation, and performance monitoring of grants lie with individual state agencies. State grants are regulated by state law and policy. Requirements span the full life cycle of a grant, from pre-award through active grant to post-award and closeout. The 13 policy framework established and maintained by the Office of Grants Management covers requirements for request for proposals, conflict of interest, application review, grant execution, risk assessment, grantee monitoring, payments, financial reconciliation, grant closeout, and financial evaluation. The OLA highlighted in a hearing last session that through their audit work, they discovered that the Office of Grants Management is ahead of the curve, being one of just a dozen states to have statewide grants management policies in place. Within the Department of Administration, the Office of Grants Management, often referred to as OGM, was established in 2007. It provides leadership, training, and oversight to the state's 32 grant-making agencies. In addition, this office manages its own set of grants with a portfolio of 95 active grants totaling $54.1 million. OGM has been and continues to be a small but growing division. From its inception in 2007 to 2023, the office grew from one to four individuals, three of which were dedicated to administering admin's own grant portfolio. Until 2023, one individual conducted the policy work, training, and technical assistance for the state enterprise. The 2023 legislature made a significant investment in OGM, which has allowed the office to more than double its staff from 4 to 9 today, with plans to add 2 to 3 additional positions by the end of fiscal 2026. While the discretionary authority of admin is strong, the legislature has resourced OGM for only 12 people. We have staffed up our training capacity and training offerings since 2024, which directly supports enterprise compliance with our policies and support fraud prevention, standardization, and continuous improvement across the enterprise. OGM trainings are not intended to be sufficient for grants management staff. Agencies themselves must also train their staff on their agency-specific and program-specific internal controls, procedures, and data systems. When agencies reach out for input and coordination on their internal training, we work with them. We've also staffed up in our risk assessment and response, including legal action and suspension and debarment. These are reactive activities to investigate suspicious activity and remedy breaches of contract, which have been a growing part of our work due to the bad actors in the Medicaid programs. The more time we spend reacting to fraudsters in the Medicaid area, which are not state grants, the less time we devote to fraud prevention, risk assessment, and response to state grants. We're in the process of developing a plan for selective agency compliance and oversight, which reviews admins, Office of Grants Management, is not resourced to act as an audit team on an enterprise scale, similar to the role that the Office of the Legislative Auditor holds. Even the OLA does not review all granting agencies at once. As I mentioned earlier, under our current framework, grant making is decentralized, and agencies that are closest to the work must do the work for the monitoring and the administration. Admin, our Office of Grants Management, is not resourced to take this over or to even verify compliance on a transaction-by-transaction basis. As authorized under 16B.97 Subdivision 4, we will be selectively reviewing agency compliance with our policies. The legislature also strengthened our oversight authority and added tools that help us combat fraud, waste, and abuse. Our Deputy Commissioner, Stacey Christensen, will speak in further detail to these authorities and the work that has followed up over the last few years. Before turning it over to her, I'll close with this. Fraud against public programs, whether it be social service programs, Medicaid programs, or state grants, is not acceptable. Our work at Admin through our Office of Grants Management is focused on ensuring policies are in place, grant staff are trained, and that every tool at our disposal is deployed to ensure appropriated grant funds are spent as the legislature intends. With that, I turn it over to our deputy.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Stacey Christensen. I am the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Administration. As the commissioner mentioned, the resources and new authorities the legislature has provided to OGM and to all state agencies that are charged with state grant administration have been impactful. They've allowed for new and significant work to occur to proactively reduce risks in state grant making and, when needed, hold the bad actors accountable. In previous testimony before this committee, I talked in depth about OGM's implementation of the various new authorities and work in the area shown on this slide. In the interest of time, I will not repeat all of that, but I do want to highlight some important areas. First, in the area of pre-award risk assessment, a lot of OGM's focus has been on proactive prevention. We would rather find agencies in a position where they have detected abnormalities, position themselves to investigate, and in appropriate circumstances, avoid an award to a grantee that is a bad actor or otherwise incapable of fulfilling the purpose and intent of the grant. The pre-award risk assessment process has been instrumental to that end. OGM has provided extensive training on how to conduct these pre-award risk assessments that are required prior to awarding any grant contract valued at $50,000 or more. Beyond training, OGM has prepared a detailed policy and toolkit complete with checklists, sample letters, templates, tip sheets, and flowcharts to support agencies in this work. OGM has added additional training staff to build agency capacity to detect, prevent, and respond to misuse of public funds and promote consistency across the enterprise. We conducted a training needs assessment to determine highest risks and common knowledge gaps across the enterprise. We developed updated training content on grant contracts, RFPs, pre-award risk assessment, financial review, and fraud awareness prevention. We determined approximately 2,000 state staff are required to complete the 2025 legislative training mandate, and to ensure compliance, we employed four ways for agencies to satisfy the mandatory initial grants management training by the end of July of 2025, including through a new course via the state's online learning resource, the Enterprise Learning Management System. We designated a two-hour grant fraud awareness training as required annual ongoing training for FY26, one for staff and one for supervisors and managers. We have 951 completers of the two-hour fraud awareness training to date, and will be delivering this training every month for the rest of FY26. OGM will deliver more than 50 virtual trainings by the end of quarter three of FY26. So far in FY26, over 4,000 participants have completed OGM trainings. Information sharing and investigation are key to fraud detection prevention and our oversight role. When OGM receives notification of suspected fraud or abuse, the team takes action. The first step is to utilize the state's SWIFT system to determine if there are active grants or recently active grants within the enterprise. If so, OGM reaches out to the agency and requests any pre-award risk assessments, monitoring reports, and to see if they have seen any red flags. OGM also conducts online research for news reports and the entity's website to identify individuals and affiliates, and searches SWIFT for those names. OGM reviews agency materials, reaches out to the BCA, the OLA, and in some cases law enforcement to find out if this entity is on their radar and what, if any, information they can share. They compare and compile documentation from relevant agencies and law enforcement. If the suspicious actor is under investigation, such as by the BCA or the FBI, we can provide grant contract agreements, payment documentation, audits, or other materials from state agencies that may be helpful to those investigators. If the individual is in the legal system, we monitor court records through PACER. We can and have required agencies to audit specific grants and report back to us. We can and have required agencies to notify law enforcement and connect with the Attorney General's office on grounds for recovery of state funds. We can and have required agencies to stop payments and or terminate a grant if they haven't already. Our aim is to determine whether there are grounds for suspension or debarment and what information needs to be shared with agencies so we can act in concert to avoid confusion, redundancy, and loss of state funds. So my final thought is to highlight one that is used as both a proactive and reactive tool, the ability to suspend or debar grantees and potential grantees. By law, a suspension or debarment can be effective for up to 3 years. We have suspended or debarred individuals and or entities 23 times since May of 2025. Most of these entities and individuals were bad actors that defrauded Medicaid or other federal programs, and we have suspended or debarred to keep them away from state grants. We utilize our state SWIFT system to help facilitate the process, marking an entity as debarred or suspended, and remove the open for ordering indicator, which prevents a SWIFT user from creating a new purchase order. Agencies are required to check the suspended and debarred lists before issuing grants. There are two lists on admin's website. One is a combined state list managed by OGM and the Office of State Procurement, and the other list of vendors debarred by the federal government agencies. A grant cannot be awarded to an entity suspended or debarred from doing business with the state of Minnesota or with the federal government pursuant to OGM policy. In closing, while OGM has accomplished a great deal, particularly for a new small team, we know that there is much work ahead. This will come in the form of additional agency trainings, particularly training available in the state's Enterprise Learning Management System. We will also see more compliance work with verifications, including engagement with agencies with significant audit findings. We will continue to engage our partners, including MMB and others, as we seek to leverage resources and knowledge. And finally, we will work toward greater accountability through data sharing and follow-up. With that, we're happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I just want to say, I think that you're, this is good. So I know we expanded your staff a couple years ago, and you're trying. So you went from a group of four or whatever to, I think you had up to 15, I thought you could do. I can't remember the number. So, but this is a similar situation to OMB, where they're in charge of, they oversee the grants management. They set controls, but they don't have the authority to actually force the agencies to do it. Perhaps they should have more authority to, to force something, at least force no final payment until the grant is completely closed out, these sort of things. Something that can be done. And so I hope that we talk about that as we're trying to work through legislation. Less than a month ago, there was another horrible audit, as you know. I think it was in behavioral health, where 75%, I think, if I remember the numbers right, of the grants were done incorrectly. There was some problem with the grants. And we even had staff at the agency who was falsifying records after the fact. Incredible stuff. Incredible. And so I would encourage us to continue doing the work that you've been doing, but also to find ways that we can maybe empower them even more so we don't have grants that aren't done incorrectly across the state. So we don't have falsified records by state employees, which is just, again, incredible. And I guess we should all ask who has been terminated over that. It should be the entire department head and everyone else in that thing. I don't know what's happened in the last year. Probably nothing, because that's what's happened. But I just want to hopefully we can work together to just continue to figure out ways that we could do grants better, because there are huge dollars of fraud, as you know, within the grant system in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a quick question. So referencing the OLA report on the behavioral health grants, it was shocking. And the fact that employees were backdating and falsifying documents is unconscionable. And my understanding, to your point, Vice Chair Anderson, is that no one has been fired. There's an investigation going on. But I hope there will be accountability there, and we should expect that from the agencies. But one of the things I've seen in other reports is that often the agencies allow not only, so in this case, the agency personnel were backdating documents and falsifying them, but that if there's a site visit on a contract or a grant and they don't have their paperwork in order and they don't have their attendance records, they don't have the proof that they need for whatever you're looking for, that rather than hold them accountable for that, they're allowed to submit it later and it still counts, which also could be false documentation. If you go on site and it's not there, but you're still allowing it to be submitted later, can you confirm, in fact, that is happening? And if it is, why do you allow that? And what is the policy that would flag that or stop that? We should stop that.
Madam Chair, I can't speak specifically to what happened in that audit. Certainly, OGM policy would, not allow for backdating of documentation or, that type of thing. I'm not sure, policy is set and policy has certain requirements. It is then up to the agencies to make sure that they are complying with the policy. There are certain situations, kind of in the provider space that aren't state grants, that aren't subject to our state grant policy. And so I think it's just going to depend on a situation, if you're doing site visits to a provider or, what type of kind of funding is at play.
Thank you. But in this case, it was a behavioral health grant. And there was an anomaly, $640,000 or something to one place that was completely out of line. And then the person left and took a job there. And there was falsified documents. So you say you have a policy against falsifying documents. So when that policy was violated in this instance, what are you doing about it? What happens when there's a policy violation?
Madam Chair, if there's a policy violation, there is, again, kind of similar to what MMB was discussing, there is not kind of an enforcement mechanism that the Department of Administration has.
So what kind of enforcement mechanism do you need? MMB, do you care to comment on this? Like, to me, this is the crux of the problem, right? We have one agency responsible for grants, one agency responsible for all the other finances of the state. And in both cases, you have a lot of policies, a lot of procedures, but when they're violated, no one does anything. Can you speak to what do you need so that we can actually have accountability?
Chair Robbins, I certainly can't speak to the grants management policies. What I do know is in that instance, the OIG at the Department of Human Services immediately started an investigation. They paused into the grant, the grantee, the organization. They immediately paused payments and subsequently canceled the grant. They have referred this to both the BCA for a criminal investigation and to the Attorney General for a civil investigation. That's about the depths of my knowledge on this particular topic, but I'm happy to share that with you.
Thank you. So you leave it basically to the agency to make the decision. You as the agency with internal controls responsibility for the enterprise don't do the accountability piece. You leave it to each agency. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yes, it would. I mean, yes, that is Chair Robbins, that in this case, the agency has taken control of the situation and taken many steps to address it.
Okay, I have one quick more question, and then I'll go to Representative Elkins. So my understanding is that the Department of Admin has a government grant for fraud prevention and investigation, FPI grant, that goes to counties to help with fraud prevention. Can you talk about how that grant is used and how it's distributed to counties? Like, is there a formula so that based on the amount of fraud in counties, they get more or less? And how do you audit how that money is being used? Like, how much does the state get for fraud prevention grants? How is it distributed to counties? And what are we actually getting for those dollars? If you could comment on that.
Madam Chair, the Department of Administration does not have that grant. I'm not sure if maybe it's at the Department of Human Services or that is not a grant our agency administers.
So you don't oversee the grant that comes, even if it came to DHS, you're not responsible for overall management of the fraud prevention grant?
That's correct.
Okay, I'll follow up with DHS. Thank you. Representative Elkins.
And thank you, Benji. Two things. So first of all, I'd like to, comment on Representative Anderson's comments and yours. I read the latest OLA report on the behavioral grant program. It is damning. So you're not going to find any apologists on this side of the table. But one of the other things that really was striking to me about this particular one, as someone who has been now reading OLA reports for 8 years now, is that usually, there's this section at the back of the report where the agency responds, and most of the time is kind of deny, deflect, minimize. On this one, temporary Commissioner Gandhi owned it. And for each one of the findings, he said, the response was, yep, this is correct. But beyond that, she also said, okay, this is what we're going to do to fix it. This is the person responsible for fixing it, and this is when they're going to have that done. I have never seen that in an agency's response to an OLA report. And I think that a light bulb has gone on over at DHS, and they're taking this one seriously. And I think, you know, her response in this one was is what we should expect going forward. So a second thing, completely unrelated, but a question for Ms. Christensen. So she and I serve on a Minute Technical Advisory Committee on data sharing, and the legislature did pass legislation this past year that does give agencies more ability to share data to weed out fraud. And was wondering if she might have something she would want to tell us about that effort, where we are.
Yes, go ahead.
Madam Chair, thanks, Representative Elkins, for that question. And just highlighting this ability to broadly share fraud-related data across state agencies has also been incredibly impactful in allowing agencies to communicate with each other, to talk to each other, to break down those silos, and have those conversations about when one entity using grants in particular has a grant, being able to share if there have been red flags or, you know, in doing some additional due diligence, there have been kind of things that one agency has found, to be able to have those conversations with another agency that may be, you know, starting an RFP or have a grant with that agency, to make sure that we are all on the same page, we are all communicating. Up until that ability to broadly share fraud-related data, we were not able to have those conversations when some of these situations involving investigative data had not public data. So that has been incredibly helpful to try to break down those silos and try to push this fraud prevention work forward.
Thank you. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for bringing in these agencies. I appreciate the administration being here in MMB. I started the hearing with a comment, and I think, well, rather than questions, I have maybe a slightly extended comment to make. As we're at the cusp of, and actually maybe I will ask you just one quick question, Madam Chair. Do you anticipate we'll have another meeting outside the session, or do you anticipate the next meeting will be once the regular session starts? Do you have any sense of that?
Yes, our next session will be during the regular session, and then we'll meet our normal committee time, 8:15 a.m. on a Monday morning. We're back.
Brutal. Yeah, that's true. Less, you'll probably less press because, yeah. It's a struggle for many of us. Well, good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And so just as we transition then to regular session, I guess I wanted to note, maybe responding a little bit to a comment that had been made earlier, just noting that we all share just a sense of fury, and shared with so many Minnesotans, at the prospect of, and in fact, we know this has happened, of taxpayer dollars that are intended for vulnerable people, people in need, and having those dollars not go to people in need. And you, Madam Chair, used that phrase at the beginning about protecting taxpayers and protecting vulnerable people. And I think, you know, nobody's more incensed than any of us about that than those of us working hard to make sure vulnerable people have what they need to be successful in our state. So we're incensed by that. That's true at the local level, the state level. It's true at the federal level. As Representative Elkins so well put it, we read the most recent OLA report and have significant concerns from there. I know that's being looked into. We need to make sure that continues to happen. But getting back to fraud that we see at our state level and our federal level, absolutely unacceptable. And it's unacceptable when we see, as was referred to, the president pardoning fraudsters. It's unacceptable to see what we see, the loss of expertise of the U.S. Attorney's Office. It's also unacceptable what we see when there's state dollars that are going in ways that they should not go. And I'm hopeful that we can, as a committee and as a legislature and as a government, to be taking all those things seriously and pushing in all those areas. The chair is well aware of this, and others as well. I've continued to be very frustrated with the approach that we've taken as a committee. There was a comment made much earlier about whistleblowers having spoken to this committee, a reminder that We've had no whistleblowers speak in a hearing besides several who were identified by the media. We've had whistleblowers speak to the GOP members of the committee. I want to urge us all, as we have information about fraud, to make sure to get it to agencies and to individuals that can stop payments. If we have concerns about anonymity for those whistleblowers, which makes total sense, then we want to think about how we can do that in a way that makes it work. Even to say, hey, you should look at this particular recipient, can't tell you how you should know, whatever it is, but we've got to find a way forward. I am hopeful as we head into the session that we can get back to a place that maybe I think we were at the very start of this process of being able to work in a collaborative way, and I hope we could even have some specific ideas to prevent and fight fraud that we could consider in this committee, perhaps even have a hearing specifically on those ideas, take official action. Even if we can't do that, I'll admit, and if you've just felt a lot of frustration from me, it's been that my sense of anger and frustration shared by so many of us about the problem, I don't feel has always been matched by a sense of actually taking practical action. And that is a real concern that I have. I hope that we can together do that. I know we share the desire to take action on this. I think sometimes there's a lot of different politics and partisanship that goes on in all kinds of different directions. I won't talk further about that right now. But I'm very hopeful that we transition the regular session. We can really take action together and move forward to address what is a really big concern at the state level and at the federal level as well. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lee Pinto. And to your point, yes, we're working on several bills right now that we plan to introduce for session. And the commissioner from MMB said that they also have language that they're working on. And so we look forward to having that before us. And we absolutely want to make this a bipartisan effort to give the agencies what they need. Like, it's honestly incredibly frustrating when you have the statutory responsibility for internal controls and to hear you say, yeah, all you can do is provide support. Like, I'm sure I represent a lot of taxpayers when I feel like that's incredibly frustrating. So, Representative Schultz.
Thank you. And Representative Pinto, I will appreciate your comments. And I think that on our side of the aisle, this is welcome news heard from multiple members on your side of the aisle. It's welcome news. Welcome news. Okay. All right. Let's work on this together. We only have 12 weeks in this legislative session. So the conversations to put this these words to paper and into legislation really needs to happen, because as we've heard today, there appears to continue to be gaps. And it's our goal to close those gaps and to stop the fraud in Minnesota. I would invite the commissioner of MMB back to the desk. And just, I feel like we really need to work on together. And by the way, commissioner, if you could say as well, this might be for you as well. But we have this general question. After what the federal government did last summer, we have an issue with our Medicaid-funded services, in addition to our SNAP program, that our error rates are very high. And I'm curious, as you're looking at that in particular, we need to really digest this. Commissioner, I think there were some Minnesotans who were a little bit concerned when just generally talking about fraud at the press conference for the economic forecast for the state, that you said, well, you know, it's kind of absorbed in the state budget. And yet these are real dollars, right? And so my question here is really, what are we doing here to lower the error rates that we're seeing? I feel like this program in particular, especially given the news stories of late, is like an extremely concerning program here in Minnesota. So what are we doing to fix our error rates for SNAP in Minnesota to get us below that federal threshold of not higher than 6% error rate, fraud rate, waste, overpayments, and underpayments?
Commissioner.
Chair Robbins and Representative Schultz, I am not well positioned to answer that question. I think you would want to speak to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families to get a better idea of what they are doing to lower the error rates. I know that they're working on it. I also know that error rates are sometimes just data entry issues, you know, that happens, and it happens not in state agencies necessarily, but across, you know, counties and the people who are implementing these programs. And so I would just encourage you to get additional information from the agency that oversees that program.
Representative Schultz.
Okay, very good. Thank you. In addition, just, you know, for the record, like, we're 3% higher on that error rate. And my understanding is, by federal law, that as overpayments are recollected on SNAP in particular, that there is a share of that that comes back to the state. And my understanding is that goes to the general fund. Is that accurate? And if so, shouldn't counties be receiving some of those dollars?
Commissioner Campbell.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, I'm looking at our state budget director. I think that's something we'll have to follow up with you on.
Thank you. And I would like to follow up on his point. So your responsibility is to get these reviews every year from the agency heads that they followed their internal controls. So when DCYF certifies that they followed internal controls, but yet we have a 9% error rate, how do you square that circle?
Chair Robbins, I'm not sure that they have an internal what their internal controls are specific to their SNAP error rates. I do know that every state has error rates, and we are sort of in the middle of the pack. In that regard, I would need to talk to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families in more detail to understand what those internal controls look like and how we could maybe help them create stronger internal controls in those spaces. It is also, again, my understanding that this is a responsibility shared with the counties, and so it is not simply that the Department of Children, Youth, and Families they could have the tightest internal controls in the world, and because 87 counties are helping administer this program, we would still have challenges in this space.
Sorry, Minnesota is one of only 10 states that has the counties administer the program. Do you think that is a good way to do it?
Sure, Robbins. I apologize, but I'm not the right person to. I just don't know enough about this particular program to be able to speak to whether or not I think that that's a good idea.
Okay, thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have just one final question that kind of applies across the board to the challenges that we're facing in Minnesota in regards to fraud. And it's the question that I probably get the most back home and as I talk to Minnesotans. And it's my understanding that the state has the ability to recollect dollars from fraudsters. So my question for you, especially Commissioner Campbell, is what steps is your agency taking to recover the dollars that have been stolen by fraudsters?
Commissioner Campbell.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, those are things that, as I understand it, are worked through with as we are working through the legal process. So things that we work with the Attorney General's office on and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I know that I can speak to, like, when there have been instances at MMB, you heard Assistant Commissioner Moore, for instance, talking about when there is not the type of fraud you're talking about, but when there is an issue where a vendor has had their bank account information stolen and a fraudster has successfully received a payment that was intended for a vendor. In those instances, we have worked with the BCA and other partners, banks, in order to try to recoup those resources. I know that in that the instance that I'm thinking of, we were not able to fully recoup those resources. We received a percentage. We could get you more detail on what that looks like.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be really quick on this. I think that this effort hopefully can be something that we can also work across the aisle on because it's what Minnesotans really, really care about. So you do have administrative authority to do that now. We need to work more at that and get that money back into either the state coffers or back into the people's family budgets.
Thank you. And I just want to follow up on that. So one of the other things is that we have not only do we have a high error rate, but it seems like we had a huge number of people that were getting duplicate benefits. And so back in February of 2025, we had 52,899 individuals receiving duplicate benefits while living in Minnesota. But then in the May report, which comes out quarterly, that was down to 9,849. So can you explain how you what happened to all those people? Were they just cut off? And how was that duplicate number allowed to grow so high? Like, do you have a threshold where it triggers an audit or something when you're looking at these duplicate benefits? Could you address that?
Chair Robbins, that program is administered by the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and they would need to speak to those specifics.
So do they report that to you in their annual certification? Like, you should be, like, do they talk about what you get in those reports that you get annually certified by all these agency heads? I'll put a data request in. We want to see those, because if they're reporting 52,000 people getting duplicate benefits and then nobody does anything, I'd like to understand where this breakdown in the internal controls happens. That's what we're trying to get at the root of here.
Chair Robbins, I can tell you that that is not the type of thing that would necessarily show up on their internal controls certification. If it's an overpayment, there are, of course, requirements in statute about what to do in those instances, namely to refer those things to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I know, because as an employer, we do this with our employees. If there's an overpayment made to an employee, we collect that money. Sometimes that's painful. We'd be doing the same thing in these instances.
Okay. Lead Pinto. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just clarifying, I know we sort of stumbled into SNAP, and we don't have a Department of Children, Youth, and Families in front of us, but just to note, and folks look at the USDA 2024 document that was in the handouts, our error rate is less, and it's not a rate of fraud, it's a rate of payment errors, is less than the national average. Nearly a third of the payment error rate consists of underpayments, people not receiving benefits that they should be receiving. Quite a few states, our state has been targeted with the federal funding freeze. Quite a few states that have not been targeted have significantly higher rates than ours, notably Alaska and Oklahoma, a number of other states as well. And just a reminder that in the federal reconciliation bill passed by the Republican Congress, you're supposed to get your rate below 6% unless your rate's above, I believe it's 10%, which in fact, then you get a delayed implementation and you don't get penalized at all. So that was sort of how they set that up, is actually potentially incentivizing, encouraging payment errors. And so just kind of a reminder that there's more that we need to do, and at some point we'll be able to get Department of Children, Youth, and Families in front of us if folks are interested in this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I think we're all set. Thank you for your testimony and your time today. We appreciate everyone coming. This is a very important issue to us as a committee, because you do have the statutory responsibility for internal controls. And we see failure after failure of internal controls across all these agencies. So if you need more authority to implement your statutory responsibility, I would love to have a meeting with you, and let's get a bill together, because just saying, oh, we're going to provide more support hasn't worked. So we need to have something that has more authority. So thank you very much. We're adjourned.